Okay, I believe before just administrative matter, are you, Mr. Morse, Mr. Stravinsky, are you dividing up your time?
Yes, we are.
You got an agreement on that, what you're doing?
Yeah, we're praying for like 15 minutes and
okay, well, just know whoever goes first eats up the other one's time if you don't. Don't stop on time. Okay. I don't have that noted here, so I just want to know if you two were all copacetic on that. Okay. Mr. Davis, you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Josh Davis, and on behalf of the Joseph Saveri Law Firm, I represent plaintiff appellant Insulate. Insulate is a contractor and purchases Fastset equipment, also known as FSE, in order to install insulation, and alleges that it has paid super competitive prices, inflated prices, for the FSE as a result of anti-competitive conduct by the defendants. Now, 2 months after the trial court issued its order dismissing the complaint on a motion to dismiss, this court issued its opinion in Wholesale Grocery, and it's plaintiff's position that the holdings of Wholesale Grocery provide substantial guidance and warrant reversal on two of the primary issues in this case, which I would propose to discuss in order, the first being the statute of limitations, and the second being the existence of an agreement to serve as a predicate for an antitrust violation. So in regard to the statute of limitations, what Wholesale Grocery clarified is that in the Eighth Circuit, as in most other circuits around the country, that each new sale at a super competitive price to a purchaser who did not itself participate in an anti-competitive agreement constitutes an overt act, and that overt act during the statutory period triggers a continuing violation, and therefore plaintiff can pursue overcharge damages based on it. And the trial court did not use that measure to gauge whether the statute of limitations had run, but rather suggested that the first purchase in circumstances like these would be sufficient to cause the statute to run and would prevent the plaintiff from availing itself of the continuing violation doctrine. So that, we think, is the clarification this court ordered issued after the order and warrants reversal on that basis. I would note that, because this has cropped up in the briefing, that mergers are different, and that's clear, that Section 7 of the Clayton Act, which pertains specifically to mergers, for good policy reasons, you can't unscramble that egg once it's happened, and so there is case law that says the continuing violation operates differently in that context. This is not that context. Here we have allegations of a broader conspiracy involving, among other things, a series of exclusive dealing arrangements. I will add beyond that, that's sufficient, we think, for reversal. I will add that beyond that, there were additional overt acts that occurred during the statutory period that would trigger the continuing violation doctrine, even if one were not to accept our first argument on super competitive prices. And I'll name just a couple of those.
Well, don't you have to... isn't that what you pled that we're looking at now, as opposed to additional acts?
So we had pled under the continuing violation doctrine additional acts, so that are found in the complaint that we believe also would trigger a new statute of limitations.
You aren't trying to introduce new acts.
No, these are in the complaint as well. I apologize for any lack of clarity.
Well, while you're on that, In Re Wholesale Grocery, do you allege, and I don't recall you do, purchases within the statute of limitations?
So two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, we argued in our briefs, and none of the defendants contested, that because the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, unless we conclusively established in our allegations that purchases had stopped, then it wouldn't be appropriate to dismiss at this stage because the burden to plead and to prove is on the defendants. It is true that Greco, in a footnote, noted or suggested that there were no allegations of purchases during the statutory period, but it didn't take the next step and say, and therefore the statute has run. We would also point out that we think we do have an allegation in the complaint, one or more, that is sufficiently suggestive of purchases during the statutory period, so that even if the burden were shifted, as we think it should not be, to plaintiffs, we still have alleged purchases. And that would be in paragraph 10 of the complaint.
Paragraph 10?
Paragraph 10 of the complaint. And in paragraph 10 of the complaint, plaintiffs allege that Insulate suffered damages in the form of an overcharge. And in addition, the paragraph goes on to say, all of these acts unlawfully limited the choice among brands of FSC available to plaintiff and raised or unlawfully maintained the prices of FSC charged to plaintiff, all of which has resulted and is still resulting in harm to plaintiff by virtue of the fact that they have been overcharged for Facet equipment. So the language of is still resulting in, we think, given the burden that we have, which is we just need to not plead ourselves out of court on an affirmative defense, should suffice to establish that there were purchases during the statutory period if the court were to require that. But again, we've argued it's an affirmative defense, and the contrary argument was not made by defendants. The other bases for establishing an overt act on which we would rely, there's two incidents that occurred during the statutory period. One is that Gamma PMC, one of the competitors of Graco, ends up becoming a manufacturer and designing new products and launches those products in October 2009, which is during the statutory period. The statutory period runs all the way back to June 14th, 2009, which is 4 years before the filing of the complaint. And in October 2009, plaintiffs allege Gamma PMC brings these new products to market, and the distributors refuse to carry it, the new product. And so we would say this is a new overt act during the statutory period, and the case law makes clear that as compared to a terminated contract, which doesn't constitute a continuing violation, when there's a new refusal to deal, and I would rely here on Lomar Wholesale and Pioneer, that constitutes a new overt act for purposes of the statute of limitations. And then finally, in October 2012, Graco sends out a letter apprehensive about Gamma PMC and this new product on the market and says to distributors, guys, don't carry this Gamma PMC. Be sure you don't do that. And we would say that that is the kind of fine-tuning that the courts have recognized is sufficient to trigger new statute of limitations. So we have various arguments in that regard. If I might, the next issue, the next primary issue on appeal is whether there was the existence of an agreement to serve as a predicate for an antitrust violation. And there are three ways in which we think we've adequately alleged an agreement for these purposes. The first is direct allegations of contractual obligations. The second is allegations that move this case beyond what's called the Colgate safe harbor. And the third, I hope it's not too cute, call interstate circuit on steroids. So as to the direct allegations, the plaintiffs not only allege that each of the distributors entered into an exclusive dealing agreement with Graco, but they allege in paragraph 115 of the complaint that Graco sent out a letter in October 2007 and indicating that language from the contract that Graco had with distributors, and this letter is generic, so it's by its nature, it's a common letter sent out to North American distributors suggesting they all have this term in the contract. It suggests that the best efforts clause in the contract requires exclusive dealing, and that if the distributors choose to carry a competitor's goods, in this context Gamma PMC, that would be a violation of the best efforts clause. Now,
Graco argues, as I understand it, well, first of all, that that's a unilateral action. It's not evidence of an agreement. But putting that aside for a moment, they also argue that this is, in essence, a hub-and-spoke conspiracy, and that controlling precedent requires you cannot have what's referred to as a rimless hub-and-spoke conspiracy. There has to be some agreement between at least some of the distributors. Is there any allegation of that in the complaint or evidence in the complaint to support that?
There is evidence. We've alleged that in fact the distributors were involved, and we have alleged a rim. So that's one issue. And in fact, this October 7th.
Is there anything in the complaint to back it up beyond the bare allegations?
Absolutely. So there is something more beyond the bare allegations. For example, one of the issues that arose is that Foampak, what turns out to be Graco's number one distributor, twice says, hey, we're thinking about defecting from this overarching agreement and carrying another brand, a competing line of FSE. And twice, Graco reaches out to Foampak and says, don't do it, don't do it. And in fact, the second time in 2009, actually sends high executives to New Jersey to meet in a Holiday Inn with the president of Foampak and to get them back in the fold. Now, there's a few things that are important about that. One of them is that we allege, and we think this is sufficiently specific at the pleading stage, we allege that Foampak and other key distributors, but specifically Foampak, participated in drafting this October 2007 letter, which we think certainly goes beyond just general allegations of their active participation in this scheme.
I know this is a motion to dismiss.
Yes.
It hasn't been discovered, but what's the evidence that they participated, or do you have any evidence of that?
Well, we have the allegation that they did so. It is a motion to dismiss. And so, I mean, the standard under Twombly, and I think this is one of the things that was lost a bit in the trial court, is there just has to be a reasonable expectation that discovery is going to be able to prove the existence of an illegal agreement. That's the language from Twombly. And we think we have that and far surpassed that, but we don't. So there's no evidence beyond the allegation that it occurred, which we think, being non-conclusory, must be taken as true at this stage.
To what extent is the FTC investigative file a matter of public record that you have access to?
It became a matter of public record in April 2013, just 2 months before the complaint was filed. And so we've included that now, and much of the information establishing this alleged antitrust violation, comes from information that was not available before then. There was a competitor action, but most of the records were sealed, and so plaintiffs were not in a position to file until that time. I do want to address some of these other points, though, that were raised, both about unilateral act and the hub and spoke conspiracy. So on the unilateral act piece, it is true that Graco argues there was a unilateral act, but the language from the letter is at best inconsistent. Wholesale, what Graco says is, hey, we've got a deal and you'll be violating it and we will punish you for violating it if you don't abide by this best efforts clause. That is the clear implication, we think, of citing a clause in an existing contract and saying to its distributors, you better just carry us. Now, there is language later in the letter that implies, well, wait a second, this is unilateral action. But this is where wholesale grocery comes back in, because in wholesale grocery, there was an explicit agreement to allocate the market, but the plaintiffs alleged that the allocation extended well beyond the explicit agreement. And this is at summary judgment, where there's a higher standard, but still reasonable inferences have to be drawn for the plaintiff. And what this court said is, you can't count on every would-be monopolist to be so foolish as to put in writing every anti-competitive thing it's doing. And so what this court did is it drew every reasonable inference and maybe some unreasonable ones against the plaintiff in interpreting this letter. That's not the right standard, and it's not consistent with wholesale grocery. What the court should have done, we respectfully submit, is said, yeah, here Graco is citing this language from his statute. That is suggestive of the fact that there are exclusive dealing agreements, and once there are agreements, the lower court opinion should have come out the other way. Yes, it's possible the inference could be drawn in the opposite direction. We wouldn't deny that. But that at most would mean plaintiffs shouldn't win at summary judgment down the road, not that defendants should win at summary judgment, much less that they should win on a motion to dismiss at this stage. So we think that paragraph 15 does go far enough to establish an agreement. We would also point out that there are other grounds for inferring the necessary agreement. The Foampak episodes are an excellent example. And this is where the Colgate safe harbor comes in. The Colgate safe harbor says that if a manufacturer like Graco simply issues a policy unilaterally and says, you got to engage in exclusive dealing, and even I'll terminate you if you don't, and does nothing more, that's not an agreement for purposes of the antitrust laws, and we readily acknowledge that. But as later case law has made clear, once you start seeing the company engage in protracted interactions that are suggestive of negotiation and agreement, then that it's crossed out, the Graco has crossed outside of that line of the Colgate Safe Harbor, and the foam pack incidents are a great example. Once Graco flew out top executives to meet with the president of foam pack and said, hey, don't do it, and then as we allege in paragraph 128, once foam pack acquiesced, especially with the background of the agreement in paragraph 115, we're way outside the Colgate safe harbor. And indeed, in Monsanto versus Sprayright, there were less inculpatory circumstances. There was no background contract with an exclusive dealing arrangement. And the court said that the kind of interaction described here is enough to establish acquiescence, and acquiescence is enough for a Section 1 violation. So that's the second way in which we think we've satisfied the agreement issue. There is a third way, which is about the hub and spoke. And one thing I do want to emphasize about the hub and spoke argument is it's important to identify what is and is not at stake there. Without a hub and spoke, with just a hub and spoke, Graco with just a series of hubs, agreements with its individual distributors, that's enough to have an agreement. The rim may move that agreement into a per se violation. The lack of that rim just means that you'll proceed under the rule of reason. In fact, one of the cases defendants rely on, Dentsply, said, hey, there's no rim, that's a problem here. But it explicitly said, the 2010 decision, and I think the page is at 255, but I'd have to check my records, said, but we're not going to reach whether a hub and spoke would be potentially its own independent cause of action, because that's not what the plaintiffs allege. Well, we allege it here. I see my time is running short, so let me just identify two issues and then answer any questions the court may have. One is standing under Minnesota antitrust law. I think we can be brief on that. Plaintiffs have alleged throughout the complaint extensive conduct in Minnesota. On their motion to transfer, defendants themselves have said this is the hub. They've argued it in their appellate argument. That's all enough for plaintiff to be able to bring a claim under Minnesota antitrust law according to its express terms and to establish standing. It's really a very simple issue, we think. On rebuttal, maybe I'll say a little bit more.
How significant is the motion for judicial notice of these other documents?
I'm sorry?
How significant is the motion for judicial notice of the other documents?
I don't think it is significant in the sense that we think we've absolutely should the motion to dismiss should be reversed without those documents. Most of those documents were either addressed by the court or at one point attached to the defendant's motions, and for transparency, we put them in. We think they're supportive of the plausibility of our claims, but we don't need them. So with that, I would like, unless there are questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Morning, Mr. Morris.
Mr. Szafranski, good morning. May it please the court, this is a case where the plaintiff tried to plead a variety of antitrust conspiracies, but alleged no facts to support them. The only facts regarding the defendant's conduct actually alleged in the complaint describe distributors' acquiescence in a manufacturer's unilateral policy, something that 96 years of precedent has said does not constitute an agreement subject to the antitrust laws. Now, the argument you just heard focused on the October 2007 letter that Graco sent to its distributors, unilaterally announcing its preference for exclusive distributors of Fastset spray foam equipment. But the letter, and it's important here, it did not say that the distributors are already contractually required to be exclusive. In fact, the letter said the opposite, and it's at page 555 of the appendix. It said that distributors are free to sell competing Fastset equipment, and that distributors had to make independent business decisions on what products they were going to carry. Now, it's true, Graco said in that letter that because of its unilateral policy, it might choose to terminate a distributor that sells competing equipment. But that does not indicate either the existence of a pre-existing agreement to be exclusive, nor does it transcend the boundary, the sphere of protected action established by the Colgate decision in 1919.
Isn't it a little contrary on its face?
Well, Your Honor, it's not contrary on its face because nothing in that letter states that the existing requirement requires exclusive dealing. The fact that it's threatening to terminate an existing contract as opposed to, let's say, sue for breach of that contract is consistent, and it's consistent with Graco's own statement that it is taking this position unilaterally. And if the plaintiff is going to rely on this letter as the linchpin for its allegation of a conspiracy, it has to take the whole letter, and the whole letter has to be considered.
Now, there was a prior agreement, correct? They had a prior distributorship agreement, right?
Yeah, the complaint says virtually nothing about the distributorship agreements, other than the fact that they might be terminated on 60 days' notice under the termination clause if a distributor decides to take on a competing product line.
So what we have is a pre-existing distributorship agreement that's then, I don't know if you want to use the word, clarified by this letter to say that under the best efforts clause of that pre-existing agreement, if you sell a competitor's product, we're going to terminate you. I mean, that'd be a fair reading of the letter.
I don't think it's actually clarifying the meaning of the agreement or the distributorship agreements, because all Graco is saying is that, you know, it's in our opinion that selling competing product lines may interfere with the best efforts. But that doesn't.
That says it will. Well, may significantly reduce.
Yeah, but that doesn't say that the contracts, that does not indicate that the existing contracts were exclusive dealing agreements. In fact,
it goes on to say, if you sell a competitive product, we will immediately review our business relationship and may change it. I mean, you know, this is a motion to dismiss. And right. So a reasonable inference of that letter, construing it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, which isn't even the standard in a motion to dismiss. That's a summary judgment standard. But is that you sell somebody else's product, we're going to terminate you. Isn't that
right.
A reasonable?
And that is consistent with the Colgate Doctrine and the Monsanto Doctrine. And to say that the threat to terminate a contract pursuant to one of those unilateral policies then turns the existing contract into an agreement that embodies that policy, if that's the law, there would be nothing left of the Colgate Doctrine. There would be nothing left of Monsanto. And the only other allegations, factual allegations in the complaint, is one reminder of the policy to Foampak, who is not a defendant in this case, in 2009, and then a letter in February 2012, which again says you are free to carry legitimate competitive equipment, and simply says that if the court determines that Gamma products are not legitimate, then that's what's going to then.
What about the meeting? What about when the senior executives fly out and have the meeting at the Holiday Inn with the Foampak executives when they're threatening to leave? And
yes, and the message, you know, quoted in the complaint is simply, again, reiterating the unilateral policy and giving this distributor a choice. They can either sell Graco products exclusively or they can be terminated. It simply says if you do take on the Gamma line, you'll receive a letter notifying of you of 60-day termination of your Graco distributorship. And that's no different than what was specifically upheld in the Jeanery versus James Jeans case from the Ninth Circuit from 1988. That was a case in which the manufacturer announced a unilateral markup policy that every retailer needed to apply a keystone markup. And in fact, the complaint and the evidence in that case was that the manufacturer actually went out to the retailers and met with them, reminded them of this policy, told them that if they didn't comply with the policy, they weren't going to get the same treatment. They might be terminated. Their orders might not get there as quickly. And none of that, according to the Ninth Circuit, went outside the protected sphere of the Colgate Doctrine. Because, again, Colgate, and this was expressly reaffirmed and expanded in Monsanto, in order to have a Colgate Doctrine, there has to be at least some permissible level of communication in advising dealers.
Let me ask you this. I understand that you can have exclusive contract. I mean, Dairy Queen can clearly say that the Dairy Queens can't sell Ben and Jerry's ice cream or anybody else's. Just going to do Dairy Queen. But here you've got an allegation that they monopolize the market. In other words, taking my analogy, Dairy Queen. Dairy Queen owns 90% of the ice cream retail market. And if they then say, okay, you can't sell anybody else's, or we'll terminate you, does that make a difference? Because they are so all-powerful that they now have monopolized the market?
Not in this appeal, Your Honor, and that's because Insulate has not appealed the dismissal of the monopolization claim under Section 2. That's out. Insulate's also an indirect purchaser, wouldn't have standing to sue under Section 2. And in the state law claims, Insulate's complaint doesn't allege monopolization. Instead, the only conduct they allege under their state law cause of action are agreements in restraint of trade. So ultimately, all of the claims in this case come back to the question of whether there is an agreement that's been pleaded with the specificity required by Twombly. And originally, they pleaded a hub-and-spoke theory, which every circuit has said requires an allegation, a plausible factual allegation, that there is a rim connecting the wheels, or a rim of the wheel connecting the spokes.
What's your response to the argument that that's not the law when it comes to a rational basis test, which then we do get back into the market share analysis?
So if there's going to be a hub and spoke conspiracy theory, which is one that would be able to allow them to sue all the distributors and not just their own distributor, and remember, they're suing 31 other distributors that they haven't said anything about what they did, what they said, what their agreements was, only that they complied with Graco's policy. But without that, then the entire global conspiracy falls away, and now we're looking at 32 mini-conspiracies based on what they believe is an allegation of a vertical agreement between Graco and each distributor. And so if the hub-and-spoke conspiracy is gone, then you can look at Graco's agreement with Intech, which is Insulate's distributor. And there is nothing in the complaint about any agreement with Intech. There is nothing in the complaint other than Intech's compliance with Graco's unilateral 2007 letter. Now, I do want to address some issues on the statute of limitations. Now, the 4-year statute of limitations has expired here because Graco's policy was implemented in 2007, and they simply do not allege any new and independent overt acts within the 4-year limitations period. Now, it's important to keep in mind that in not every case do ongoing sales by a distributor or by anyone else alleged to be in the conspiracy, and not all cases do those equate to a new and independent overt act.
You're not disputing there were sales within the 4 years?
No, I'm not disputing that. I believe what we do argue is that there is no allegation of any refusal to deal with Gamma within the 4 years. I can address that in a moment. And that's what fundamentally distinguishes this case from the Supreme Court's dicta in Clare is in that case, the conspiracy was price fixing. And the selling of goods at a higher price, that would be a new and independent act that is part of the violation. In this case, there is simply a policy that was enacted in 2007. And what they're alleging is, on an ongoing basis, it's still resulting in higher prices on and on, which is simply the type of inertial consequences that the court has rejected, not just in merger cases like Midwestern Machinery, but also in non-merger cases like Varner versus Peterson Farms from 2004. And this court, in fact, in Midwestern Machinery, made very clear, even when you're a purchaser, the statute begins to run at the point in which it first causes injury. As the court said, in that case, it was purchasers who were claiming that they were being overcharged by Northwest Airlines. And because there was allegations that they sustained injury in the form of overcharges more than 4 years before they filed suit, that was enough to cause the statute of limitations to begin running, because they could sue then not only to recover the damages that they had already incurred, but also to recover future damages or to seek an injunction. And the court found that even the fact that future damages might not be quantifiable, might not be able to be calculated, that doesn't matter. As long as the fact that of injury and damages were calculable as to past damages at that time, that was enough. Regarding the enforcement of the boycott, so the complaint really doesn't say when or who made any refusal to deal to Gamma. I know counsel's argument was that, well, they launched a new product in 2009, and therefore they must have been refused after that point. But that's not what the complaint says. In fact, the complaint says that they were trying to sell through Garif, a Spanish company, back as early as 2007. And at some unspecified point, some unspecified distributor was unwilling to carry that product. That's not enough to plead a new and independent act under Twombly. And in fact, we cite Z Technologies, a Sixth Circuit case from 2014, involving a non-competition clause where the plaintiff had alleged, well, this provision was ongoing for multiple years, causing us to pay higher prices, and it was enforced because they weren't allowing this plant to be released to a competitor. But the Sixth Circuit said that, well, without an allegation of a specific refusal or a specific action, that is not enough to satisfy Twombly and therefore not enough to satisfy the continuing violation doctrine.
It sounds, with all due respect to your argument, it sounds a lot like you're arguing wholesale grocery. You have not mentioned wholesale grocery once in the argument, and it almost sounds like you're saying wholesale grocery was wrongly decided.
No, Your Honor. In fact, wholesale grocery is consistent with this position on the statute of limitations, because in wholesale grocery, this court was very clear in the fact that it believed that the anti-competitive nature of the agreement at issue was not revealed until several years later, and that the prices were not increased until several years later. In fact, the court reaffirmed the proposition that the limitations period begins to run against customers only when the customers have reason to know of the violation and their damages are sufficiently ascertainable to justify an antitrust action. And we have both of those criteria met here. In fact, Judge Montgomery dismissed the fraudulent concealment allegations and found that they could have brought this case as early as 2008. And none of that has been appealed in this case. And without that, there is a clear distinction between this case and wholesale grocery. With that, Your Honor, I'll reserve the rest of my time for Mr. Morris.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Safransky, is that correct?
Actually, I'm Chris Morris, Your Honor, from Bastard Remedy.
Oh, that Mr. Safransky?
That was Mr. Safransky.
Oh, okay. Well, I apologize, Mr. Safransky, to call you Mr. Morris. I'm sure that has harmed you to the core. Okay, Mr. Morris.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm here to speak on behalf of 18 of the distributors who are remaining as defendants in the case. There is one other remaining defendant, individual pro se by the name of Jack DeMita, who did not file a brief. I'm not, as far as I know, he's not here. Mr. Safransky had mentioned that there were an excess of 30 distributors originally in the complaint. Many of those were dismissed voluntarily shortly after the case was transferred from Pennsylvania to Minnesota. But I just wanted to share a couple of comments in terms of our perspective on this complaint as to the distributors. Now, the district court dismissed the claims against the distributors on multiple grounds, including failure to state a claim and statute of limitations and standing issues. And we'd ask this court to affirm, and I want to focus my comments on the failure to state a claim.
I don't want to cut off your argument, but
that's fine.
I thought the appellant made a pretty compelling argument on standing when your side made the allegation that to the extent there was a conspiracy, it was centered in Minnesota. So why don't they have standing to sue in Minnesota?
Your Honor, I just don't think it's fair to say that these 18 distributors spread across the country entered a conspiracy here. The plaintiff is out in California. Their supplier is, not surprisingly, out west. Okay, Intec is in Arizona. It might come to a surprise to Intec that an Arizona company selling a product to a California company should be subject to some state law claim in Minnesota. But regardless of whether they're standing, there's a four-year statute of limitations there as well, and I don't think they come close to meeting the sufficiency.
I mean, it just sounds counterintuitive to file a motion to transfer venue on the basis that all the genesis of the actions, the center of the alleged conspiracy all occurred in Minnesota, and then when you get to Minnesota, say, well, but now you don't have standing to sue in Minnesota. It just sounds counterintuitive.
That may be, Your Honor. The plaintiff, for whatever reason, thought this case should be in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure why that was, but originally they pled claims under most states, I think, of the nation, but we're down to the California and Minnesota claims. So in terms of the allegations against the distributors, it's interesting. You heard a lot about Foampak. That's the one distributor that they make specific allegations as to, not named as a defendant, even in the original complaint. What they do with the rest of our 18 clients is they lump them together, and they allege where they do business, and that's it. Then they go from that to the conclusory, well, a letter was sent in 2007, and you all entered an exclusionary contract with Graco because you signed what were likely boilerplate distribution agreements for short term, and then you got this letter. They do make some allegations about subsets where they say, well, we think that some of the key distributors communicated among themselves because they went to trade shows. So who among my 18 clients are the key distributors? No idea. Then they talk about that some of the key distributors talked to Graco about this 2007 letter. Well, who are they? No clue. No way for any given client of mine to figure out, are they in that key group that actually did something that might be lead to some conspiracy? And then Judge Montgomery really hit this issue spot on when she talked about in her order about, is this even plausible to begin with, that all these distributors would have entered a nationwide conspiracy with Graco, no matter their size or shape or form, whether it's a mom or pop or a larger distributor. And that is, if you're in the shoes of a distributor and you get a letter from Graco, a supplier of a major product, who's now one of the only, if not only, the only supplier in the country because they've purchased other competitors, and Graco says to you, we'd like you not to carry other product. Well, the plaintiff, to their credits, admits that Foampak had no other really practical business choice, right? Foampak had to rely on Graco product, would be perhaps out of business if they went the other way, so they made the decision to carry only Graco product. Now apply that to the mom and pop distributor in Rogers, Minnesota, or somewhere in Texas. Is this court to presume that they should have had not that same legitimate business reason to act independently and go ahead and follow that suggestion on their own? There's no basis in the complaint or in the giant record that they attach of the pleadings from that Gamma litigation or the FTC litigation, no suggestion that any of these distributors would have been more logically doing this by way of a nationwide conspiracy. And certainly the FTC made no such allegation. The FTC made no allegation that the claim should be brought against distributors, nor did Gamma in that litigation. So with that, I see my time's up, and I thank you.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Davis, you have a little over 3 minutes.
I have left myself a paltry amount of time to cover a great deal, so I will try to address topics, and please, if anything's on your mind, of course, let me know. Let me say a couple of things. One, in regard to the role of the distributors and economic evidence and the like, we have allegations, we think, in paragraph 115 that embody an express agreement. And when there's an express agreement, or at least suggest an expressive agreement that's adequate with each of the distributors and Graco, that should suffice at the motion to dismiss stage. We don't need to look for circumstantial evidence. We don't need to look at the plus factor of acting against economic self-interest. And it is, I think that the opposing counsel drew inferences about a different way to read this letter, and that would be fine if we're past summary judgment and you were a jury, but you're not. And so I would respectfully submit that's sufficient as against the arguments of the distributors and against Graco. In terms of acquiescence, opposing counsel said acquiescence is not enough. I would direct the court to Monsanto v. Sprayright, where in footnote 9, the court says actually acquiescence is precisely enough when you have the kind of back and forth that Graco had with Foampak. In terms of the hub and spoke and all of that, opposing counsel relied on Genery to say that the kinds of evidence we don't have is enough. Let's be clear, that was in Genery, that was after trial that the court affirmed a judgment of the jury against plaintiffs. And all we're saying at this point is let us get to trial and let us give it at least summary judgment and have a shot to prove our case. The idea that we have to prove that if we have a hub and spoke conspiracy without a rim, that these are separate conspiracies, that's not true. It's contrary to Interstate Circuit, where what the Supreme Court said was, in some ways, this case looks like they took Interstate Circuit and what was illegal and used it as a playbook, because they sent out a letter just like an Interstate Circuit. It was to all the distributors just like into Interstate Circuit. It contemplated a common scheme. There was actual compliance, even down to the detail that the distributors changed their practices in Interstate Circuit. And the court said not necessary, but strongly suggestive of the overarching conspiracy that means everyone is potentially liable. Here they changed their practices too. The complaint alleges that it used to be distributors carried multiple products, and then they changed subject to this broader conspiracy. We also do allege monopolization claims. Those are allowed, so there's no agreement is necessary there. We allege that under both Minnesota law and California law, particularly the UCL. We do refer, we cite to the relevant statutory provision in the complaint, which obviously doesn't have to contain legal argument. We do refer to restraints of trade, but that can be in service, as Your Honor suggested, of a monopolization claim. A monopolist can use agreements in service of a monopolization claim, so those are not at all inconsistent. The last things I'll say about the statute of limitations, I do think that defendants are fighting the grocery case that you recently decided. I will note also that plaintiffs alleged a lack of knowledge, so even under their reading of wholesale grocery, the trial court didn't say we had knowledge. It said we lacked due diligence. And so we've alleged what we need even under their reading, which we think is implausible. And with that, Your Honor, I see my time is up, so unless you have any questions.
Well, thank you both for your arguments.
Thank you.
Obviously an interesting case, and for me to see what mess I've created within wholesale groceries. So having this come back to haunt me, we'll see. We'll take it under advisement and be back to you in due course. We thank you for your arguments. Thank you.